This is California Burning, a co-production of North State Public Radio, made possible with generous funding from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. I'm Matt Fidler. The purpose of this series is to strengthen our understanding of the wildfires that we've been experiencing here in California. Not just so we know why these fires are happening, but so we can do something about it. Because these fires are getting worse, causing more damage, more smoke, and affecting the way that we all live in the great state of California. This is the second episode in a five-part series. All episodes can be found in podcast form wherever you get your podcasts or at californiaburning.net. In the first episode of this series, we talked about the history of the U.S. Forest Service and how we were taught and, well, directly told that fire in our forests is bad. Fire is always bad. It destroys trees. It pollutes our water. It puts smoke into the clean air. And it's dangerous. It burns our homes. So we need to completely eliminate it from the landscape. We were told this over and over again as the United States expanded into the West. Soon that became, only you can prevent forest fires, which we learned in the last episode just isn't true, because you can't stop all forest fires. But we can prevent catastrophic, out-of-control wildfires, like the ones we've been seeing in California lately. And one way of doing this is by setting low-intensity, controlled, or prescribed burns, the way the Native Americans did it. This is why I'm camping at the Yurok Indian Reservation.
Whoa, Wendy.
There is something amazing about fire. When we put fire on the land, there's something about it that just, it speaks to your spirit. It's like you connect with it, and you connect on a deeper level with the land. And it is so gratifying to be able to take care of the land in the way that our ancestors did, and to provide a service for the community.
That's Margot Robbins of the Yurok tribe in far northern California. She's the president of the Cultural Management Council and a cultural practitioner of fire. We met in the tiny village of Wichipec at the edge of the Yurok Reservation. I hop in her car and we start to drive deep into the forest.
All right, so we're recording now.
The history of the treatment of the Native Americans is, of course, a tragic one. But this episode is about learning from the past, not lamenting it.
How far are you taking me up this hill here? I'm
going to take you deep into the forest and leave you. Hey. You might want to start dropping breadcrumbs.
Cutting the ice, Margot drives me to a place where I can see some of the benefits of a prescribed burn.
We're going to go up here a couple of miles. We did a controlled burn up here about a year and a half ago. And the purpose of this burn up here was to propagate basket weaving materials, hazel. So hazel is a serotonous plant. It needs fire to reproduce new shoots. And we use those new shoots that come straight up out of the ground for basket weaving.
Baskets were used for everything, from collecting food and other materials. They cooked with them, they ate with them, they even fashioned baskets to carry their babies. A Native American family in California could have easily gone through 100 baskets each year, but for the last 100 years or so, it's been illegal to burn the landscape, which meant they couldn't get the sprouts that they needed for basketry.
The only basket materials that we would be able to get is if there was, we have a lot of, I call them renegade burners. Cal Fire calls them arsonists. But people tend to like starting fires from down there on Highway 169. And sometimes they'll be in a place where there's hazel. And so we would go out and pick. And then there was a period of time in the 60s when the powers that be came to realize that the landscape benefits from fire. And so Cal Fire and other places were more fire friendly and actually doing some prescribed burning. And so there was a period of time when people could burn. And I'm not sure when exactly that changed. And then they started throwing people in prison.
That period of time was when ecologists and people like ranchers and hunters who had experience working with and on the land started understanding the fire-adapted nature of these forests. But the federal and state agencies didn't like the idea of setting fire to the land. Partially because of liability, partly due to the complaints about smoke, and partly, and this was mentioned in the last episode, but I'll say it again, as a firefighter, your job is to put out fires, not let them burn. So in order to climb the ranks at the fire department, fires need to be fought, whether that was good for the long-term health of the forest or not. So as Margot said, the powers that be shut the conversation down by throwing the people they labeled arsonists in jail. And before that, Margot says the punishment for Native Americans who were caught burning was much worse.
In the early 1900s, late 1800s, the Native people were actually shot for doing controlled burns. The Europeans were afraid of fire, and they did not understand it. And so that was a pretty effective method of shutting down fire on the landscape.
And this is where Margot's role comes in. As president of the Cultural Management Council, she's bringing back the culture of fire, partially to revitalize her people's tradition of basket weaving.
Since the fire suppression area came in the early 1900s, it was very, very difficult to get sticks, and the art of basket weaving was dying out because we had no materials to weave with. And so as a community, we decided that the number one most important issue facing our community was this lack of fire on the landscape. And so as a community, we decided to bring fire back to our ancestral territories, not only for basket weavers, but to protect homes, because the landscape is so fuel-laden. It's just brush, brush, brush everywhere, thick with brush. And so it creates a huge fire hazard. And so in order to protect our homes and to have basket weaving materials for basket weavers and to make the land healthy again, we brought fire back to the land. That was 7 years ago we started burning. And since then we have continued to burn twice a year during our traditional burn windows, which is the spring and the fall. But we have to go by the laws that have been put in place, not only by the state, but federally. And so when we burn, we have to have people with NWCG qualifications. It's like the national qualification system for firefighters.
And while this can frustrate Margot and others trying to bring back the culture of fire, the population of California just topped 40 million people. And we developed a culture out here where we make everything out of wood because it was plentiful. We also live in a state with many different stakeholders: private landowners, the federal government, the state government, and local municipalities. So getting all these stakeholders to agree to anything is difficult. Then, of course, there's the fact that we're a litigious society where lawyers make a lot of money. So we sue one another whenever we make a mistake. So the idea of setting fires, which if aren't done carefully and at the appropriate time and place, can turn deadly. And that scares those who might be considered liable. But that doesn't take away from the fact that fire is how these forests were maintained for thousands of years, and the forests adapted with those fires. That's why on this episode of California Burning, we're going to learn a lot about the Native American practice of managing the land with fire, how they did it, why they did it, and what this can teach us about our forests today in the modern 21st century world as we struggle with a wildfire problem that is seriously threatening our way of life. And I know, we can't go back to the California that the natives knew. Basket making just isn't a huge priority for most Californians these days. But we'll never figure out how to properly manage these forests if we don't take what they did to cultivate this land seriously. This concept of maintaining a forest through prescribed burns was first introduced to me by fire geographer Don Hankins.
Wow, what a beautiful ledge here.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, we're really right up on the top of the ridge.
He teaches pyrogeography at Chico State University, and I met him in the town of Forest Ranch, just a few miles into the foothills from Chico, and just a few miles north of where the campfire destroyed the town of Paradise and the surrounding communities. Up in Forest Ranch and the Big Chico Creek Ecological Preserve, he's been doing research on how bringing fire back to the landscape can improve forest health.
How frequently should fire be put into any given area to maintain the full spectrum of the resources that you would need in that area, right?
Using fire to maintain resources, not just get rid of them. This is why I'm walking through the forest with Don, a Plains Miwok, showing me around Forest Ranch, an area that used to be home to the Konkau people.
So traditionally speaking, the people who lived in this area were speakers of the Konkau language, Koyum Kaui. Locally in Chico, the Machupta tribe in Chico has ancestral ties to this area. They burn a lot, and that's what maintained that open forest.
This idea of an open forest is an important one. An open forest has large trees with a canopy that covers the ground in shade, but has branches that you can walk underneath to pass through. The forest floor isn't too covered in dense chaparral and brush, or small trees so close together that they don't have room to get big or let you walk by them. An open forest is also fire resilient because large trees don't burn easily. And if there isn't a bunch of dead branches, brush, and pine needles on the forest floor, it won't burn real hot or spread fire real fast. But most of our forests today are overgrown and dense with small trees, brush, and forest litter. Sometimes we call that forest fuel. And those dense forests are more susceptible to drought-borne illnesses and pest infestations, which then kills more trees, causing more forest litter, making an even bigger fire hazard. Our forests are overly packed with small trees and brush because they haven't been maintained with fire for around 100 years.
You know, as we kind of look at the early settler records and early forestry records, densities of trees in the neighborhood of 40 to 100 trees per acre, right?
Yeah, that's not that dense.
No, it's not very dense. And, you know, and so when we look at this, this is probably at that upper end, right? Where, you know, if we kind of look at the small trees and the big mature trees, there's probably close to 100 trees per acre in this little area.
And this area has been maintained with fire recently. And that's why we're here. But much of our forests are packed with 500 or even 1,000 trees per acre. But the natives did these burns for a lot of different reasons.
So I like to think about it like this, that if we're thinking about things in a native cultural perspective in the landscape, you've got to think about, well, what are you getting out of the landscape, right? As we're standing here and as we walk through this section of forest, I can look at things that are culturally important, that you want to have fire on those plants.
Can we take a walk and you point some of those things out?
Let's walk and talk.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing that pops out to me are these native grasses. You know, we've got blue wild rye growing here. The blue wild rye popped in as soon as the canopy cover opened up.
Is that this?
That's long tubed iris.
Okay.
Which is also another cultural plant. But the rye, as soon as you get the sunlight in here, you know, you reduce the canopy closure, the rye starts coming in. But this grass needs to have, from what I've seen on other research areas, if we're not burning it to maintain it, it slowly goes away.
So is that how it seeds? Through fire?
It's not seeding through fire, but the fire helps to maintain a place for it within the landscape. So that's why fire is really important. So burning for this grass is really important, right?
And animals eat this grass?
Animals eat the grass. The seeds are edible. The stalks of the grass would be used for baskets. It's useful. It's useful, right?
Cool.
By burning for different things at different times and different places, we're helping with wildfire prevention that goes well beyond just cleaning up the forest fuel load. By setting prescribed burns at appropriate times, we're encouraging more biodiversity in the forest ecosystem by not just letting a few of the species dominate. Disturbance of a system encourages and often speeds up biological evolution, which creates greater biodiversity. And more biodiversity equals more resilience. Resilience to those kinds of disturbances. Resiliency to fires, to floods, to droughts. But without any disturbances, biodiversity decreases, with the most dominant species taking over the landscape because nothing is stopping them. And in this age, that's going to be the invasive species that have no natural competitors to keep them in check. Star thistle, Scotch and French broom, and the Spanish wheat varieties that have taken over all the native grasses. And those native grasses were drought and fire resistant. This is why Don is so passionate about bringing back fire to the landscape. He lives in Forest Ranch. Forest is in the name of his town, and he wants that forest to be healthy, beautiful, and a safe place to live.
We're talking about it more. Are we going down this
path?
Yeah,
we can go. I don't know how far you want to go.
Yeah, or just a little bit.
We walk on Doe Mill Ridge, looking into Butte Creek Canyon, until we come to two different prescribed fire sites, which were burnt the previous year. One in the middle of February, and the other in April. In this particular instance, they learned that this little gap in time of the year makes a big difference on how the burn affects the forest.
On this south side of the trail, which we're walking along a fire break right now, on the south side, they burned this in April, right? So this burned in February, this burned in April. And if you look at the difference between the two, you see a lot more scorching of the crowns of these ponderosa pines.
Yeah.
It's mostly ponderosa pine, right? The reason why is that in February, these pines were not actively growing to the extent that that they were at this time. So we've got really no evapotranspiration, no moisture being taken up through the root systems. Over here, we've got photosynthesis in process. These plants are growing. They've got a lot of moisture in the stem flow, and fire's coming up, and it's heating and getting trapped up underneath these canopies, and the plants are opening up their cells, and that water is being lost so rapidly they can't replace it. Hence, you see all these brown trees.
Oh, okay.
So there's, you know, roughly, you know, I'm thinking.
I mean, are they dead? Will any of these come back?
Those are all dead. Yeah,
they're dead.
They're dead, dead.
If you didn't quite catch all of that, Don said the burn in the winter, when the trees are almost dormant, a low-intensity fire won't do much damage. But in April, the snow is melting, or melted. The sun is getting hot in the day, and the tree is pushing water and nutrients from the soil into its system. But when the heat of a fire comes along, it dehydrates that tree system, which is more vulnerable now, leaving it to be burnt. So in this burn area we're looking at from April, while the fire did clear out a bunch of the underbrush, it also killed many of the pine trees that they wanted to survive. Those trees will now eventually fall, exposing the ground to sunlight, which will bring in fire-prone weeds and brush in its place. But the good news is that at this elevation, there's still oak trees. And the oak trees that die in a fire often stump sprout baby oak trees, unlike the pine trees.
Yeah, they don't stump sprout. The oaks will stump sprout, and you see some stump sprouting of the oaks around here, like these ones over here, which are also culturally important, right? Like, you may not realize, but those sticks from the oaks are important for like rims of big gathering baskets and things like that, because it's a hardwood, and even some of the baby cradles, you know, it's like, this is, you want to burn like this so that you can get that sprout. And then, you know, up in this area, the cradles for the babies have forks in them. So like they'll go for an oak that's regenerating from a fire and has got, you know, the perfect fork to it.
Huh, that's cool. And so that was the basis of their baby cradles.
Yeah, yeah. And it requires fire, right?
Wow.
Yeah, fire from birth.
The Concow people used oak sprouts for baskets. The Yurok used hazel. And other native Californians burned for a variety of different reasons depending on their culture and traditions. We're going to take a quick break, and during this break, I'd like you to contemplate how this burning of land by over 100 different native cultures in California made for a unique landscape, one that was full of diverse plant and animal life, which increased the land's resistance to fire. Similar to the famed Galapagos Islands and the distinctiveness of plants and animals there, most of California is a biodiversity hotspot due to geographical isolation. In the past, California was secluded because of the Pacific Ocean to the west, the unformidable mountains and volcanoes to the north and east, and vast deserts to the south and southeast. In fact, the early Spanish explorers of the New World first thought the state was an island. That's why they named it California, after the mythical island in the romantic 16th century Spanish novel, Exploits of Espladon. The island in the story is full of riches and great beasts made of gold. It's populated by strong black women, guarded by griffins who will eat any man to set foot there, and is ruled by the great Queen Califia. You're listening to California Burning. I'm Matt Fidler. Stay with us.